Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's March 8th, 2020, and welcome to episode 209 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and also our first computer jobs. We are joined today, first off by me. I'm Earl. Hello, everybody. Earl here from Portland, Oregon.
Hello, Earl.
Pacific Northwest. To my right and in the upper quadrant is Blake. Hello, Blake. And actually, Blake, I don't know where you are in the world. Where in the world is Blake Patterson?
Blake is from the Washington, D.C. area. I'm actually a few miles outside of D.C. in Alexandria, Virginia, so Northern Virginia. But the D.C. area. And
okay.
It's a sunny 73 with a little breeze right now.
Feels like spring.
It was 29 degrees Fahrenheit last night. So interesting.
Wow, that's quite a range.
Yes. Good to be here.
Yeah, good to have you. And clockwise from you is Jack. Jack's coming to us live from Sweden.
Yes, I am.
How you doing, Jack?
Pretty good. I am in a new apartment I moved into a couple weeks ago. Anyone looking at the YouTube stream will see that my walls are very, very sparse. There's like nothing behind me. That will change eventually. But I'm good. I moved from a furnished apartment into an unfurnished apartment, which means that I must furnish it. So there are certain things that I don't really have, like a proper bed and a sofa. So it's a work in progress, but it's good.
How do you like the place so far?
Earl was going to make the same joke.
Well, I didn't hear what you said, Earl.
Oh, well, what were you going to say, Paul?
I was just thinking that this is probably the best place to be if you need to find furniture, where the IKEAs are thick on the ground.
That's right. Yeah, you stumble over those flat packs everywhere.
And then continuing the clockwise theme, we've got Paul Hagstrom from the Boston area. How are you doing, Paul?
I am doing fine. A couple hours before we finished, before we are recording now, I finished editing the previous one. So I'm feeling very, the weight is lifted for this, the time of this recording.
We really appreciate the work you go through to edit those. I know it's a lot of effort and it shows in the final product.
Thanks. Yeah, it's just a busy time elsewhere as well. So that's why it's mostly going slowly, but
gotcha. Yeah, things have been really busy for me too, and it looks like they're gonna lighten up a bit on the work side, so hopefully I'll be able to jump in on RCR a little bit more frequently here, which is gonna be that'll be fun. Well, it'd be fun for me. I don't know if it'd be fun for the listeners, but you're stuck with me anyway. So our host topic today is kind of a continuation. We've been doing this ongoing, so we're going to do it again. And we're talking about our first computer job. It's a topic near and dear to my heart. But Jack, I don't think you've covered that topic for you yet. Is that correct?
I think that is correct. I think there's some things that I've mentioned about some of these things in the past, but not necessarily this exactly. Like, I guess it depends on what are we considering a job? Are we considering something that where we actually collect a regular paycheck, or something that someone pays you to do with computers?
I think it's squishy. I think you can define it how you like.
Okay. So what I'll do is I'll do both.
Okay.
My first thing where someone paid me to do something with computers was when I was a teenager in Austin, Minnesota, and my girlfriend at the time worked at like a – it was kind of like a Hallmark gift card store. They had greeting cards and maybe some books and stuff. I think maybe there was a bit of a Christian element to the store also. And the guy who was her boss, he had a computer that he was using for whatever. It was some kind of PC. I don't know if it was an IBM or if it was some kind of compatible. This was probably 1987 or something. And he had some kind of Bible software that he wanted installed in this thing. And he didn't have any computer skills himself whatsoever. And he wanted to have this Bible software installed. And there was something particular about it. I don't remember what exactly it was. I remember I helped him install it. And what he also wanted to do was he was hoping he could use this. He wanted to have some kind of like Bible study circle groups. And he wanted to connect his IBM PC or his PC compatible, whatever it was, to a television in his living room. And so that they could look at it together, whatever they were, you know, because I guess you could search in the Bible. You could bring things up or whatever, search for words, I guess. And what I was able to determine with the small amount of resources I had available in Austin, Minnesota, which was the local Radio Shack at the mall, was that there was nothing I could do for him. I did not conceive of any way to take this thing, which had, you know, probably just like a CGA, VGA monitor output and generate a TV compatible signal. That probably existed somewhere in some form at that time, but nothing that I could actually like purchase or get my hands on. He paid me something anyway, because at least I got the software installed for him. I don't remember what he paid me, but he paid me something. So I guess it was not really like a job. It was a task, a couple of tasks, which I did as best I could when I was 15 or 16.
It's a little consulting job.
Yeah, a little consulting job.
Yeah.
He paid me something. I don't know. He paid me. It was for sure in two digits of dollars he paid me.
Excellent.
I mean, like before the decimal point.
Yes. at least two digits. No, not at least. For sure. Two digits to the left. It was not $100. It was less than 100. But I guess my first actual like job, like a recurring job involving computers that I got paid for, was actually my student job in college, where freshman year I started working for the I forget what the unit was called. It was sort of like a network technician kind of thing. We were responsible for some like IP style networking, but a lot of it was just like serial networking. So at this campus that we had these boxes distributed all throughout the campus through all the academic buildings, and the boxes had a bunch of serial ports on them. And then all the rooms were wired with twisted pair wires going up to hook up terminals. And so my job involved a lot of somebody would call in and say, hey, this terminal stopped working, or it could either be sort of like a dumb terminal, or it could be a PC or a Mac, and things would stop working. And then I would go and I would trace down the problem, which usually involved plugging something into the jack in the wall. There was this thing that like generated kind of a beep on the wires, and then there was like a little wireless thing. I would go down into the switch room, which is usually in some closet somewhere, and find where that pair of wires was.
You were toning it out.
I was toning it out, and then I guess that sounds better than what I described. Toning it out, and then I would disconnect it from a terminal server. That's what these things are called. I would disconnect it from the terminal server, and then maybe plug something in there, trying to figure out if that port was actually dead or what. And if that port was dead, patch it to a different port. And it was kind of fun in a way. It was also kind of like, you know, I'm not going to name names or anything, but I know you probably remember this guy, Paul. But the guy who I was working for was. He was like the most lackadaisical employer you could ever imagine. Like his workday consisted of, and I'm not kidding, 8 hours a day sitting at his desk playing Minesweeper. That was all he did. And he would send us, his minions, out to do all these tasks. It was pretty incredible.
Wow, that is so weird. That was my first computer job.
What, the Minesweeper?
Yeah, Minesweeper.
You were that boss? at a different college campus.
Just kidding about the job part.
Yeah, I've you know, like the couple of times that I've had sort of cable installers come for various reasons or whatever, I always kind of like watch over their shoulder to see what they're doing. And they're often doing something that's kind of similar to that. You know, like they've got some sort of like little signal generator and they're trying to figure out like, is it making it through the wires in the wall or like, where's the port outside the building that corresponds to my room and stuff.
Right.
Just been kind of pleasantly hands-on about that.
Yep.
So was your job just the physical wiring aspect of it, or did you actually support any of the stuff on the terminal server?
I didn't do much of the terminal server. There was also stuff involving like printers and just kind of like general like troubleshooting, some amount of PC troubleshooting. Like typically someone working in an administrative office, they would have something where they couldn't print or their keyboard stopped working or whatever. And they would call us in for those things too. Although the biggest problem was really the copper wire pairs for the terminal servers, that something would go amiss. And sometimes you could have a port that would seem to go bad, and then later it would be okay again. You unplug it for a while, and then later it was okay.
The physical side of networking is just so weird sometimes. Wi-Fi is kind of like that too, don't you think? I mean, it's like it'll be working just great, and all of a sudden it's like, I don't know, it rains or something.
Yep. Anyway, the other thing that was pretty fun about that actually was that we weren't using – so like in these closets where you would have a connection from the terminal server to a set of wires going up to a point in an office somewhere, like there were not just like – it wasn't just like RG45s. There was a patch panel. So you would take the four wires and you had this tool. You would put the wires on these four little – sets of double prong things sticking out, and a tool that would slip over those and go ka-chunk, 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 ka-chunk. It was pretty fun.
Was this to put the RJ45 on the end of the wire, like a little?
No, this was just in the closet. So you just have like a, there was just like bare wires on one end.
Oh, a punch down tool. Yeah, yes. Like a 110 block punch down tool kind of thing.
So like there was kind of like, as I recall, like the terminal server would be wired up specifically to this whole, like a whole column of these sets of four. And then there was another whole column of sets of four somewhere else coming from the offices. And you would cross connect these basically. That's how I remember it anyway.
Those punch down tools have such a satisfying sound.
They do. It's really sort of, you press them in, it's like, ka-chunk, and you have to give it a lot of force. If you get the right amount of force, you get the satisfying ka-chunk. Related in a way. So when I moved into my new apartment and I got the router that my ISP sent me to use, and like in my living room there were a couple of RJ45 jacks in the wall, and I'm like, okay, neat. And I plugged into one, didn't work. I plugged in the other, didn't work. And I was like, what's going on? Eventually, I realized there were RJ45 jacks also in each of the bedrooms. And just like exploring the apartment, I eventually realized that there's an electrical panel in the hallway that has the circuit breakers, and in there, there was a piece of networking equipment, and there were six RJ45 plugs, sockets, that I just had to patch across. So I took an Ethernet cable and stuck in like – so like it was kind of neat to see that already sort of equipped in a space I moved into, that there was already networking stuff there.
Nice.
This feels like a modern world we're in. Mm-hmm. So that's me. That's my whole info about my first actual computer job.
Awesome.
So how about you, Earl?
Well, my first job, so the summer before high school, I had my one and only run-in with the fast food world. I worked at a hot dog place called Der Wiener Schnitzel. There's a chain. I don't know if they still exist, or I don't know if they're around the world, but it was in Southern California. And that did not go well for me. After 3 weeks there, we kind of mutually decided that, yeah, this wasn't a good fit. So... I moved off from that and then didn't do anything for a little while. But then a couple of years later, and I'd already been in middle school and then high school working with computers, with, you know, starting with punch cards, which really, I guess, kind of dates me, and then with the online terminals. But loved the PC stuff. And I thought, coming into my senior year, I don't want to just work another fast food job or something like that, but I do need some pocket change. So I started calling around the computer stores in the area. And in this particular time period, computer stores were all the rage. And in the LA area, we had tons of them. So I figured, you know, if I just keep calling and make a pest of myself, eventually I'm going to get a hit. And I called a few different ones, no bites there, but then, no pun intended, but then I wound up calling this one called Computique. And they said, sure, we're looking for some people. So I went in, I chatted with them, and they met me and they gave me a job anyway. And the this store was so much fun because it wasn't just computers. They had all kinds of gadgets that were fun to play with. They had video games. They had all kinds of digital watches, Casio, Seiko, really some nice stuff. I mean, some of those Seiko watches were gorgeous. They had programmable calculators. So you had both the TI and the HP line of programmable calculators, along with all the goodies that went with them, little mini printers, barcode readers, different program packs that you could plug into them for, I don't know, different things like construction calculations or scientific calculations, that kind of thing. They had the Speak and Spell. I'm telling you, this store had everything. And sometimes the store was busy, but sometimes the store was empty. And there's only so many times that you could clean the glass counters and re-merchandise stuff. So I did get to play quite a bit with all the things they had there in the store. One of the things that I walked away with, I actually decided to buy with the employee discount, was an HP 41C calculator, which I love. HP for the win, yo. I'm a RPN guy all the way. You know, I know the TI versus HP is still a thing people talk about, but they really shouldn't, because HP is the clear winner of that particular conversation. And they paid me just slightly above minimum wage, which was cool. And it worked around my schooling. In fact, I talked to my guidance counselor in high school and said, hey, I've got this job. And they said, hey, we can give you credit. And I said, hey, that's great. So I actually got credit for a high school course for a work study program. All I had to do was just periodically bring something from my boss that's saying, yeah, he's still working here. I mean, we're not going to say how he's doing, because but you know, he's here. So high school credit. Got to work with all the computers. I mean, we had all the computers. We had Apple, we had Atari, K-Pro. When the Osborne's came out, we had those. We had the HP 85 computer, which was just such a weird beast, but it was fun to play with. And I got to see a couple of machines that came through there that were, they were kind of, not on the beaten path, like the Apple III. We had the Apple III in there. And
excellent.
So, I figured you might be interested in that, Paul. So I got to learn a little bit about how SOS worked, the operating system for the Apple III. Just all kinds of fun. So that was my first job, and sold a bunch of computers, but sold like a ton of programmable calculators. I don't really know if we had students coming in there, if it was primarily business people. We didn't chat it up too much, but sold a ton of the 41Cs. Those just flew off the shelf because I was so enthused about it personally. I mean, people could see that. It's like, well, I'll just buy one. I don't even need it, but this guy loves them.
he seems happy.
Yeah, exactly. He has one. He's happy. Ergo.
Must be good.
Shut up and take my money. And that kind of launched me into my computer career, which I was thinking back on it, and I think the only gig that I ever had after that that wasn't computer-related, everything since then was computer-related, except for a part-time job that I had as a math tutor with high-end algebra and calculus. I had that, and I was thinking that didn't involve computers at all, but I think that's the only other thing that I ever did that was not a computer job. So math tutoring and hot dogs. Those were my only exceptions.
Nice. So what year was it, or roughly, when you started working at a computer store?
It was September 17th of 1980, approximately.
Cool. Approximately. Not quite sure what time of day.
I just remember it because that was such a great day. I was just starting with my senior year at high school. I had just got my driver's license. It's funny, I did it in reverse. I got the job, and then I went to my dad, and I was like, well, you know, I got a job, and I got to get there, so maybe you ought to let me get a driver's license now. He's like, oh, okay. So it was a whirlwind week, actually, and a ton of fun.
Cool.
I worked there for a while, wound up leaving there and going to a couple of other computer stores eventually as things progressed. And then from there, my next job was actually the office job with Epson, doing technical writing and some programming. But love the computer retail world. It was so much fun back then. People were just getting into computers. They were so excited about coming in. They didn't know exactly what they wanted to use the computer for most of the time. They just knew, hey, this is the new hot thing. So, kind of what should I buy?
Yeah.
And one of the computer stores that I worked at, we weren't an Apple dealership. And people would come in, they'd go, hey, can you show me the Apple II? Well, we have a couple of other, but no, I want the Apple II. And they'd just leave. And that was a little demoralizing. So eventually, we started trying to sell the Franklin. And we got the original Franklin. And that was great until Apple decided to nearly sue them into oblivion, as I recall. And so then we didn't have the Franklin. And so that was a bummer. So people would leave the store again. And I got a little bit of trauma over that, but I'll get over it eventually.
Yeah, that seems like it would be really a fun time to be working in a computer store. I mean, because that's the diversity that we often talk about, and the kinds of things people were trying and the different kinds of things computers did, like the different approaches people took to making computers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think working in the computer section of Best Buy now would be maybe not as fun.
A little more homogenous. I mean, we did have the in-store rivalries that kind of mirrored what the communities were doing. When we got the VIC-20 and then later the 64, I was the Commodore guy because I played around with the PET in my high school experience. And so I had some familiarity with how the Commodore stuff worked, whereas a couple of the other guys were the Atari 800 guys. And, of course, all the usual, kind of trash talk and things like that happened. And people love both of them. And we actually, that store... The store that I'm talking about that wasn't the Apple dealership, but it was a beautiful storefront, very homey. You could come in. It was a lot of room there, and people would feel at home. And they'd come in, and we'd talk to you for however long you wanted to talk. I mean, it wasn't like big merchandiser kind of box store. So we actually hosted the local Atari user group there, and I thought, well, if we're hosting an Atari users group, then we ought to host a Commodore one, too. So I talked to a buddy of mine. We started one of the user groups in Southern California. And we didn't know how many people we would have. We were wondering if we'd even get some of the money back from the printing that we did for membership cards. But the first time, I think we had 35 people show up. Is way more than we thought we were going to have. And then all of a sudden we had 100 and then more than 100. And we outgrew the store. We had to go looking for another venue.
Wow.
But it was fun having those in the store for the amount of time that we did, because then after the users group, we'd give people like a little special discount or something like that. If they actually, you're right here in the store, you kind of have a captive audience. So why don't you buy some stuff?
Yeah, I would think that is probably a pretty wise decision on the store's part too, to host such a thing.
Oh, it was great for them, because even if people didn't buy things at the actual club meeting, it put them on the radar for people that were excited about those computer models. So if they wanted software or peripherals or something like that for their Atari and Commodore, then they would definitely swing by.
Nice, nice. I wish I would give so much if I had the foresight to, realize that it wasn't always going to be that sort of, highly varied playing field with all the different systems. And the sort of just so many... I guess one-off mom and pops, computer stores. There was always Computer Land, and some of the other chains. But I wish I'd had the forethought to take a few photos of what these things look like. Because I write blog posts about different experiences I had in this or that store. And yeah, it just, if it would be golden to have just even like a couple of shots of the storefront to, you know, recall places that I used to hang out all the time. I didn't work, you know, as you did, Earl, in any of the computer retail. That would have been amazing. And from my perspective at that time, but I certainly didn't hang out there, more than one might imagine these places. And, I guess everyone didn't have a digital phone in their digital camera in their pocket walking around. So there weren't as many photograph opportunities, but
that's true. I one of my buddies that worked at that store chain with me, I'm on Facebook with him, and I ping him every now and again. Hey, do you have any photos of the old store? And he thinks he does, but they're in a box somewhere or something like that. So I'm going to bug him again to see if he can dig those out, because we really did have a nice storefront. There actually is one magazine article about the store that I found online. Unfortunately, it was black and white, but it talked about this particular store chain called HW Computers. And the one that I worked at was in a city called Redondo Beach, there in the South Bay area of LA. And we had nice, very beautiful design prints up on the wall and great furniture, and would love to see if my buddy has some color photos from those days.
Yeah, I'd love to see them. If he happens to provide them, please share.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I bought into sort of with a non-computing angle. I paid into, and I think I've mentioned it. I've tweeted it at the show and mentioned this in the past. But the a paid newspaper archive service, and I've used different things I've found there for the paper local to where I grew up, and I found, even though not a one of them has a photograph, but I did find advertisements from basically every computer store, ads from like early 80s in the newspaper, advertising, Apple IIc, $12.99 or something like that. And I've archived hundreds of these photos before I got out, for 6 months, and you pay this amount. I didn't want to pay it again. And I've, eventually I'll have to write things up. But yeah, I was looking for that. I was looking for photos of, of the stores. And but an ad is kind of nifty to have as well. But
Yeah, the barrier to photography was, much higher. So, and there are so many places that it wouldn't have even occurred to me to take a picture of, even though I spent a lot of my life there. And, the place evolves or gets torn down or is just gone or whatever. And, you don't get the chance again, but you don't realize at the time that you won't get the chance again.
Mm-hmm. Right. You go buy a camera. I mean, you have your camera, of course, and you pay for the film. You pay for the development. You've got to wait, a week for the pictures to come back. So it wasn't immediate gratification. So much was in the way.
Right. And then you get a bunch of pictures of like your thumb.
You get it, bad photos, and it's a shame. So many different points in my life, in my younger days, that I'd love to have one or two photos of, but.
It is possible that, like I was thinking about, like these stores might be, if there's any way to get in touch with the people who owned them, they are the ones that might be the most likely to have taken a photo of it, as it was being developed or whatever.
I've gone down this road with a few, and I've had some success, but I think that's something to do, and I probably will do that further.
I'm going to see if I can dig up some of those photos that he's got.
Yeah.
It was, I think, if I recall right, the most expensive part of the whole thing was getting the film developed. It wasn't the film. And I mean, if you had a professional camera, then that probably would have been a lot of money. But if you had just a snapshot, like a 110 sort of camera, then those weren't terribly expensive. But getting it developed was the real kicker.
Yeah.
Yep. I remember that as a teenager, especially, it's like, I had so little money to work with. Like, I didn't want to spend taking a picture of a store. Like, yeah, it would not have crossed my mind at all. Like, not for a second.
Yeah.
Taking a picture, that was for, doing something fun with your friends, your family. It was not like here's a building.
Right, exactly.
I'm pleased that on the rare occasion I took a photograph of an actual computer setup that I had. And again, it's not something I did very frequently. But, you know, I've got a few photos from like 83, 85, 89, but just a handful. But yeah, you're not, how often, you know, back then am I going to pull out the camera and take a photograph of my current computer system? It turns out not very often, but more often than some, I guess, because I've got three or four. So.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think I like any pictures I have of the computer setup was, you know, they're a result, like all of us, I'm sure, you know, like the result of a parent taking the photo of the child in front of the setup, you know? So like, right. It wasn't a picture of the setup. It was a picture of me in a big mess. Right.
Right.
You know, looking focused.
Well, that's still cool though.
Yeah. It's cool to have them, but in a sense it wasn't intentionally a picture of the setup, you know?
Right.
Right.
So,
yeah.
But I do remember taking, because the developing was such a hassle, you know, I'd stockpile them. I'd sort of like, I would wait until I had three or four rolls to develop or something before I actually would go and do it. So, I mean, really delayed gratification.
Mm-hmm. And then you're kind of surprised what's on your roll of film. It's like,
yeah, but it just, there's such a sinking feeling when, like, you know, you have one photograph of an event and it turns out that it's just blurry. It's like, ah. That's never happening again.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, we kind of take for granted what we've got these days, don't we? That's true.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you would always see, there would be that, of course, you'd get like two copies of each picture, and you'd get two copies of some strange gray haze. There'd always be that photo that, what possibly could that have been? But there it is.
Right.
That's 1/24th or 1/12th of my payment, so, yeah.
But, you know, the future generations, they can always find the places they hung out by just looking up the like security camera footage that is universally going to be available.
Frightening and true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you think? Should we talk about listener feedback? Who's talking to us, Paul?
The last couple of times I've made an excuse similar to the one I'm about to make now, which is that I have not been keeping up as closely as I've been intending to, just because everything took a little bit longer. But there are a couple things I can mention. So in an impressive move, Anthony on Twitter sent some information about the ABB keyboard. And I say that's impressive partly because just today, as I'm speaking, the episode that was in came out. So that means Anthony saw the YouTube stream. So that's very cool. So Anthony wrote, like, so last time we had a really kind of just insane keyboard. You know, it was many, many keys, many keypads, lots of function keys. It was laid out in this just really what seemed like a ridiculous way, where like all the main part of the keyboard was up above all the keypads and stuff. It was very strange. But so what Anthony wrote was that on that ABB keyboard, it is an operator keyboard for a DCS control system for process manufacturing plants. So the multiple keypads have buttons that bring up pages that act as bookmarks for part of the process and that are regularly used. And he says, we still use them at work, but newer ones. And he provided a photo of one at work from 6 to 7 years ago. And he said, you can make out the giant trackball as well. So now we know something a little bit more. It wasn't just somebody, you know, completely on a drug trip designing a keyboard. There was a reason behind it. And let's see, Vic on Twitter of Tenpence Arcade just mentioned quickly that it's quite easy to mod a ZX Spectrum for composite output. So I will try that, because that's I fairly recently got a ZX Spectrum, but I don't know for sure how easy it is going to be to get the picture out, because you know it's a PAL machine. So I was just hoping that it would be just fairly straightforward. You know, like I would just plug in my LCD thing and it would work. I'm not sure that's going to happen, but I haven't even tried it, to be honest. And then we talked a couple times ago, I think, about Populous. Carrington was mentioning that he hadn't actually even come across this game. I don't know. Do you guys know Populous?
Oh yeah, I played that a ton.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
on the I guess it was on the Amiga, and or the Atari ST.
I played on both, I think. Yeah, Peter Molyneux.
Super fun.
So it was a higher end. It was a 16-bit game.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It was very pretty. It was very graphic. I mean, SimCity type thing, but the graphics were very realistic. I don't know if realistic is the word, but just it was visually impressive.
Very nice. Yeah.
What kind of game is it?
It's a world building thing. So like you are sort of a deity, and there are little people on the ground, and you can sort of raise and lower land to give them flat lands so they can farm and build houses and stuff. Or you can sink it and just wipe them out in a flood. But I think sometimes I think what happened was that sometimes, and I haven't played this in 30 years, so I don't remember exactly, but I think flooding would occur, that kind of thing. Yes. So something would happen, and then the land, everything you built up for your little people would be kind of messed up, and you'd have to kind of help them fix it and stuff.
Mm. Right, right. Yeah.
Cool.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I forget exactly what the context was that it came up in, but Carrington expressed not knowing anything about that, and I also didn't. So, but Beej wrote to say that did mention it was published by Electronic Arts, and that they played it on the Sega Genesis years ago, and it was also available on many other platforms, which we have now got further confirmation of.
Yep.
Well, it's interesting. Something that was a console game and also a PC game. Way back then, not IBM PC, but personally,
right,
Yeah, it started on the Amiga or the Atari, and then moved over to console.
Cool,
excellent.
I imagine it would have been kind of tricky on console because it was very much a mouse driven game. You sort of move the mouse and click around. I think one of the mouse buttons was to raise land, the other was to lower land. Mm-hmm. So I guess on something like the Genesis, you'd probably just be moving your cursor around with the D-pad and clicking a button to raise and lower land.
That would be kind of a good thing. Maybe that'd be a good thing for a light gun. Use that for cursor control.
Yeah. Sure thing.
What was the primary controller on the Genesis?
It was just a joypad.
Yeah. Like a D-pad or a
digital pad. It's like a D-pad and three buttons.
I still have, I sort of stopped playing games when those things started coming out, and I still really don't even know what to do with one of those Nintendo type controllers. I have a couple, thinking I would use them to play retro games on the RetroPie or whatever it is, but it's still foreign to me.
Yeah, and I've found actually that games that are older that were designed mostly with joysticks in mind, I mean, technically you can play them with a D-pad controller also, but I've found some of them just to be really difficult to play that way, like Jumpman. Which I played so much when I was a kid with a joystick. And I've tried, like you said, but I've tried playing it with the D-pad in an emulator. And I was like, what is going on here? It just didn't work for me. Even though I've played lots of other games with the D-pad, but this is just no, it's just wrong. And I plug in a joystick in, and then it's fine. Yeah. I think there's something that goes into the design when you're designing a game that the controller is, feeds. How you actually play the game with the controller feeds back into what you're doing when you're building the game, I think. And I guess I don't know if it's a matter of timing, how people use these things or what, but there's something very, very different about it.
I think you're right. I have Amiga, Atari ST still, and I was using these when the Genesis and that generation were coming out. So I never did the console thing because I didn't really have a need to, with those computers. Right. And it was all the stick, joystick. But since then, one of the controllers I do occasionally use, it's the D-pad from the Sega Master System, which is kind of a more basic version of what the Genesis has. It's it's quite basic, but it'll plug right in and work on Atari 2600 type computer. I don't know if that's the case with the Genesis pad or with some of the others, but occasionally I'll plug it in, and there's three or four games that I'd like the feel of if I'm, playing the old school games with the pad. But yeah, for most of them, I'll start and say, oh, that's not right, and I'll unplug it and plug the 500XJ back in or, something like that. But I think you're right. Interesting.
Yeah, something.
Let's see. Is there anything else? Oh, Tobias wrote on Twitter. I think it's possible that this got missed at some point. there was an eBay auction for a ThinkaDot, and this was a computer game from the 1960s or whatever that was also fun. You know, it was advertised as being not only a computer game but also fun. And it was basically something you like sort of like drop a little marble in and it'll switch little things around. It's a little plastic thing. And there was, I think the last time we linked to something about basically the building of a prototype of that. And also another fact about the ThinkaDot that I think just got skipped over at that point was that it was designed by Joseph Weisbecker, a name I don't know apart from that, but apparently someone who later made the Chip 8 and the 1802 processor while at RCA. So the ThinkaDot actually has a legacy.
Interesting.
So that was kind of cool. So thanks, Tobias, for mentioning that. And I think maybe I will bail out of the feedback at this point. So thank you to those who tweeted at us, those who gave us feedback in some other form. I will next time talk about them.
Awesome. Well, I guess that puts us in the items of interest and news. And Blake, it looks like you've got the first one about a Canon object station. What is that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I found this on there's a nice little blog called Rare and Old Computers that I follow, and they're talking about a Canon Object Station 41, and this machine is one of a few different systems that's basically a standard PC architecture system. You know, at that point, I guess it was DOS and also Windows. These are 486 level. I think this unit is 486. There were some Pentium iterations of this. So what these are machines that were fabricated specifically to run NextStep, the NextStep operating system for the Intel. Next started out on the Motorola. On the Motorola 68K platform, and when their issues with the price of the hardware was so extreme that they created an Intel version of the operating system, and as it turns out, they also created versions for Sun and HP and that sort of thing. But they would not so much partner exactly as there was some sort of a behind the scenes connection between a company and Next, where they would have inside information to I guess deeper knowledge of driver situations, so these systems could run NextStep much more efficiently than a standard PC that you would just configure yourself. And you could configure a PC to yourself within certain parameters and run the NextStep for Intel, but it would really shine on some of these systems like the Object Station 41, which in ways related to video, for instance. The next operating system wanted it didn't care about accelerated, it didn't utilize accelerated geometry like line drawing routines, that sort of thing didn't matter in the visual display that it had. It just wanted a fast frame buffer, something that could move chunks of memory from one place to another. And so there were non-traditional video cards and video buses that these systems would use that were somewhat proprietary. And the line that I saw advertised most at that time was the Object Station. And it was, as the description goes into, it's just, a 486 PC, 100 megahertz with SCSI, on the motherboard. But it used one of the notable technologies that this one uses is a WinGen technology frame buffer. It was a proprietary video card that had its own proprietary slot on the motherboard, and it's part of the tech that supported it was on the motherboard, and part was on the video card. I know about this because I actually had a WinGen-based Next Intel system that was not from a big name like Canon. It was something, it was an Alaskan company would fabricate these systems specifically for NextStep, but at a much smaller scale. But they also use this WinGen accelerator. I've got a blog post I wrote specifically about the WinGen accelerator, and actually it ended up with comments from the engineer that designed it, which it was interesting to hear.
Cool.
But at any rate, these are you could install Windows on these things. You could install DOS, but you'd pay a great deal of money, and you could also put NextStep on it and run it very fast, much more much faster than, you know, say the 68,000 hardware, because that topped out at like, you know, 68040 at 33 megahertz. So this was a whole different level of speed. But I just thought it was interesting. The article that I found goes into details about the, you know, the specifics of the system's capabilities, that sort of thing. But I found it interesting.
What was the use case for running the Next OS on those systems? What sort of things would people use those for?
Well, I think Next Step was, and the Next machines were fairly popular. I mean, they were never extremely popular. The Next was basically done when, you know, when Apple acquired them. For a variety of reasons, the hardware was just too expensive. But the academic circles would use them, and there was significant use in government as far as rapid application development was really the core. It had its development system, used Objective-C, which was the C derivative, object-oriented, and it had a graphical interface builder, which actually was called the interface builder, and that all moved to OS X. OS X's development system, Mac OS X, is based, you know, directly on Next Steps as it evolved from the Next operating system. But basically, you could lay out an interface, put code behind it. You know, if you had a specific, maybe you're modeling, some genetics of flies, for instance. Like, there happens to be one professor released his app. He had built an app where he was teaching his class fly genetics, and you could, with the interface, you could add different traits, and the fly would change its, you know, shape. It was very, very easy to write with, you know, to tie the visual interface to the code. And so it really was, it wasn't so much that the Next machines were so super powerful that they could calculate better than anything else. It was just more the development environment. And so that was kind of the claim to fame. But again, it was, the whole proposition was just a bit expensive, and that's why they were falling.
It's interesting because the year this came out, this object station, was the same year that I started working as a software developer doing Next Step applications.
And, okay.
And so what we were doing, so I was working at a consultancy, and we were targeting mostly kind of like big companies. So like we did some work for US West in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and a variety of things. And it was interesting because at that time, a lot of companies were still using mainframes. And they knew that they had to get off of mainframes and had to get into something more modern. And if we could say, hey, we can build these systems for you that will have a nice database backend, we'll make nice GUI applications for you, you won't be running Windows, you'll be running this other thing called Next Step. And at that time, like, Microsoft Office existed in some form, but it was not entrenched as this is the tool that all businesses use to do all sorts of business. So for certain niche things, we were able to sell this. So like we had US West's whole network services customer support systems. We wrote this whole suite of applications for them. And they were all running Next Step. And they were, yeah, like saying the machines, Next Step machines and the Canon Object Station were just too expensive for most people, including even for something like US West. So they were buying kind of standard 486 or Pentium PCs. And as long as you put enough RAM in them and had a good enough at the time video card, it was pretty much fine. And I don't remember the details. I remember that there were a few video cards that could work. Mm-hmm. And like if you just had like plain Jane VGA, that would work too. But if you want to get something up with higher resolution, you had to have something. And there were a few different ones that worked, and some were better than others. I don't remember the details. But it was an interesting time. Because within just a few years later, the notion of selling anything but a Windows machine to a business client was just seen as impossible. Mm-hmm. Like the fact that we were able to do it for a few years there was pretty nice. And eventually that company transitioned more over into web development. But during the time I was there, we were mostly doing Next Step and actually some Smalltalk.
Interesting. I think that little window where, you know, Windows was around, but it wasn't, you know, and Microsoft Office, it wasn't the obvious and only choice.
Right.
I think Steve Jobs had made the statement when towards the end, when Next was clearly, you know, headed down the river, that we were always going to be the last large computer company. We were either going to be the last one to make it or the first one to fail. And we were the first one to fail. I'm maybe messing that up a bit, but yeah, that was the right at the cusp.
Sounds about right.
I'm curious, did the Next Step dev environment that you're talking about look kind of like an early version of Xcode? I mean, did you see any similarities between that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. So the interface builder that Blake mentioned was an application on the machine, and there was a separate application that was called Project Builder. And over time, these things evolved. And so when macOS 10 came out, I think at that time it was still Project Builder that was the thing. Mm-hmm. At some point, Project Builder became Xcode, but Interface Builder was still a separate application up until about 2009, 10.
Yeah. Maybe even more recently. But it directly, the dev environment, and the dev environment didn't come with Next Step by default. There wasn't the Next Step operating system. And then there was Next Step developer. And Next Step developer, I think the retail price when I bought it, in college I got the student discount, so Next Step developer was $300 with your student ID. You had to show your student ID, you know, when you bought it. But it was, I think, $6,500 for the software for an Intel PC if you got the developer version. So it was not cheap.
No, it was not cheap.
And that directly turned in, you know, that's directly from which the OS X, you know, development environment came. So
right.
Cool.
Yeah, so, I mean, in many ways, my, like, daily work as an iOS developer, I'm using the same environment I've been using for decades in a certain way. I mean, obviously it's evolved and changed, and you know, everything is different in some ways, but also it's for someone who's been doing it. Yeah, there you go. I actually have a bunch of the manuals from the Next Step and Open Step days. They're in a box somewhere because I haven't finished unpacking, but
yeah, I was just going to say, I thought that there was a specific academic version, because I'm pretty sure that's what I think. I have a box just like the one that Blake is showing on the YouTube there with like a, in fact, I think I have a couple of them. There's I really like them. You know, they look very classy.
Yeah, they're really, really high quality.
Let me focus in the video on you, Blake, for just a second, if you could show those again.
For those that aren't looking at the stream or watching the YouTube save, this is the what I at my college bookstore for $2.99. I showed the college ID. You buy it, you get this. This was version 3.2 of Next Step for Intel. I mentioned the Alaskan company that it was actually called Isesis, I recall. Anyway, you would show them your proof of purchase, because, you know, CD-ROM drive was expensive. If you needed to buy a CD-ROM drive to install it, that was a very significant portion of your purchase. Mm. And so if you showed them your proof of purchase, they would install it on the hard drive, and you didn't need to have a CD drive. So that's how I did it. I didn't actually install the CDs that came with this, but some of the manuals are very high quality, you know, production items, and the box itself, you know, it had a nice, you know, fold out sort of a cubby situation. It's something I definitely have enjoyed having on the shelf. And I've used these CDs more recently to install Next Step on a few different systems, but that first one, I didn't have a CD-ROM drive. That would be way too expensive to possibly purchase. So, yeah.
It's a little bit actually difficult to sort of collect those, but I have one of the academic bundles that I got, you know, in the recent days. It was looking back nostalgically. It was not something that I did at the time, but there's also a set, I think it's an earlier set, where the manuals are basically just white with the Color Next logo on the front. Those also look pretty cool. They, you know, having Steve Jobs running things leads to nice looking stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, the manuals that I have look like they're about Blake's vintage there, the 3.3, and I have some later ones too that are from like the 4.2. They renamed the OS from Next Step to Open Step.
Open Step.
Mm-hmm. So by the 4.2 days, it was called Open Step 4.2.
Yeah, it's interesting that I have a Next machine, and I have a HP RISC machine that both are running Next Step 3.3. I installed those from CDs, And the way I got them, the box I showed you is 3.2 for Intel. I have 3.3 installed behind me. The way I got them, and this is something many people probably don't know, but it's a nifty little historical tidbit. There was a period for about a year and a half after Apple acquired Next that they would, if you sent in the serial number, like not you didn't have to show up, you know, a receipt or anything, but you just enter your serial number and describe what the serial number was attached to. They would send you either, you had a choice, the full CD set of Next Step 3.3 or OpenStep 4.2. I did it twice, one requesting each one for each, and I got both. So I got the OpenStep 4.2 and the 3.3. They were very sparse as far as manual. There was no manual. It was, I think it had a CD that had the, you know, a PDF or something, but it was free. I think it was free. If it wasn't free, it was very inexpensive. But they ended that after about a year and a half.
I have to say, I mean, I've probably said this multiple times in the history of the podcast, but I loved programming in the Next Step environment. That was so fun. I mean, particularly I guess that would have been coming out of, you know, trying to work with Apple II programming and then a little bit of Mac programming. So I did some, you know, I'm not sure what it was, C++, I suppose it was. Mm-hmm. I learned using books by Dave Mark. Mm-hmm. With him. Jack has co-authored a book, I believe.
Yep, yeah, a couple.
But anyway, yeah. But the experience that I had with the Next Step environment was really just fun. You know, it was like amazing that you could get contextually available like manual sections if you didn't remember how a thing worked and everything tied together. And yeah,
very elegant. Very elegant. That's the word, I think.
Yeah.
Yep, I think a lot of their stuff was really years ahead of its time. And it's hard to look at Xcode right now and say that it is definitively years ahead of anything else. I mean, it's still good. I'm fine with it. I use it every day, and it works for me. But it's not as groundbreaking, obviously, as Interface Builder was in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
certainly.
Well, cool. So it also ran on HP. Was that PA RISC? Were there like...
Yes, it had. It ran on the initial 68,000. They called them black hardware. It was the Next machines. The white hardware was General Intel, including the Object Station or the more hand rolled. And the other two were there was Sun with the MIPS. MIPS
Spark
for Sun. I think on the Spark. The sorry, Sun. I'm thinking of SGI. Spark. And then HP. There were about 5 or 6 HP models that could run it. I have an HP 9000 712. It's a pizza box. It looks physically it's almost identical to a Next Station, but it's, you know, beige. But I did a little video comparison. It's dramatically faster. It's 100 megahertz PA RISC processor versus the Next machine sitting next to it is 33 megahertz 68040, and it's shocking how fast it runs. And I won't go into it, but the there's an interesting hardware video technology that HP built called color recovery that the Next Step takes advantage of on the HP workstations that gives it a pseudo true color. It's kind of like a JPEG true color. There's a little bit of artifacting with out of only 8 bits of output. But interestingly, HP never even supported that in their own HP UX operating system. Next was the only company that supported this technology. I did a blog post about that. Maybe we could link it if people are interested. But yeah,
cool.
And the HP units were called Gecko. That was the code name for that for the platform, and they were the green hardware. So in the Next parlance, and the Next, if you as a developer, you had the ability to create fat binaries that would run on all one executable package could run on all 4 platforms if you ticked the right boxes in the compiler.
Ooh. Right.
So, and that's where, of course, Apple got the double binary situation back with the PowerPC. Is that when it happened, PowerPC, or was that in the Intel switch where they had fat binaries?
I think they had them even when they were moving to PowerPC.
Okay. Yeah. But because
they moved to PowerPC from Intel. So back
from Motorola,
in what,
right?
Back, Well, no, because back in 1999 or whatever, you could get Rhapsody or macOS 10 Server or whatever, and that could run on Intel and could run on PowerPC.
Right.
And then Mac was all PowerPC for a while, and then it's like, oh, let's remember Intel again. But yeah, I remember in like 1994 or so, just like hitting those switches, building a fat binary for all four architectures just for the heck of it. Like, I didn't have an HPPA RISC machine anywhere or a Spark Station anywhere, but it was kind of fun to say, hey, look, I built this thing. If you have this, you can download it and try it and let me know if it works.
Yeah, I thought you were talking about the earlier Apple switch from Motorola to Intel, but yes, it's sort of back to Intel. I've posted a few, you know, little demos and things of the HP running this or that app, and I've gotten like a comment from someone I hadn't heard of, and it turns out he was a developer of this thing. He's like, oh, I finally got to see it running on a HP platform. He said, I wrote this, and he said, I would have bet money that it didn't run. But I guess Apple, there was the secret project that sort of saved Apple in a way, Marklar, when they came over, apparently behind the scenes, they had every step of the way, they'd been keeping the PowerPC version of OS X, like behind the scenes, it was lockstep with the secret Intel version. They were evolving it all the time. So when it came time to switch, when they decided they needed to switch away from PowerPC, they basically already had everything built. It was just a matter of, So that's an interesting thing that was obviously worth its expended resources in doing as a backup plan.
If little Next could manage to have four architectures going in the mid-90s, then surely Apple, it was no problem for them to have two.
Sure. And obviously, right now in a lab, Mac OS is running on ARM.
I am pretty sure, by the way, I was kind of like digging around and not finding it, but I'm pretty sure that we talked about that color recovery technology blog post that you...
I felt like you may have.
Yeah.
Yeah,
It's quite interesting. We can relink to it once I find. You know, I remember thinking that was pretty wild. Sort of scaling down all the colors to something small and then re-expanding it back out based on something like perception.
It's interesting to see it actually, to look at it and to observe very minutely what's going on. It's amazing. It's one of the more amazing little pieces of tech I've come across using different systems. And I spotted that in a, there was a parking lot, like a bizarre flea market, and on a bed of a truck, there was a stack of about 40 computers. And I spotted I could recognize the way the floppy was oriented out the side. And I remembered that it would run Next Step. And so I bought it for, I think, $20 off of a truck, that HP workstation, and took it home and set it up. You never know what you're going to come home with when you leave in the morning.
Cool.
Okay, so good first topic.
Yeah, that was awesome. And Blake, I'd like to talk to you offline and see if maybe my, because I've got a PA RISC machine in my collection. It's a C110, if I remember right. And it's got the pizza box orientation. It'd be fun to see if it could run the
C110.
Yeah.
I'll take a look. I've imaged all the, I've got the media. I'll take a look.
Awesome. Well, the next one we've got kind of a sad bit of news here. Because of the worldwide coronavirus outbreak, and specifically in the Seattle area, I'm up here in the Pacific Northwest, kind of, consider this whole region home. And up in Seattle, they've been hit hard with coronavirus. And one of the things that got decided, the Living Computer Museum Plus Labs has closed up for the immediate future, at least. And this affected the VCF Pacific Northwest. It was going to happen in a couple of weeks here, but it has been canceled due to COVID-19. And Paul, I think you had something you wanted to add to that?
Oh, well, I was just in, I'm on the Kansas Fest committee, and that's happening in July, but of course we're also watching this wondering, what things are going to look like in July. I can see if we're talking about, end of March, a couple weeks away, things are presumably going to be learned between now and then, but still the situation is like nobody really knows quite what it's going to be like.
Right.
As far as Kansas Fest goes, I mean, like we've been talking about it for a while, like what to do, but I mean, like in general, we're not making decisions yet, mm-hmm. essentially.
Sure. Yeah. And I'm wondering, there are some other things that we've got coming up too, don't we?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think in general, like one of the things that was, you know, that we think about when you're organizing an event or planning to go to one is, it's quite possible that you will have no say in this. I mean, you know, it could be that like Kansas Fest is hosted at a university, and if they decide, nope, we're closing the university, then that's it, right? And I think that was kind of what happened to the VCF Pacific Northwest as well.
That's right.
The computer museum just said, we're closing. So,
well, in the day job category, I work in the health IT field. And just tomorrow, actually, scheduled to start the largest health IT conference of the year, something called HIMSS in Orlando, Florida. And also, if I remember correctly, I think it's an attendance of about 40,000 people. And the whole thing got canceled. And it actually didn't get canceled very far in advance. It was kind of a last minute thing, but it was Florida working together with the venue, working together with the organizer and all that. And they just, so many things are being canceled. It's affecting us from the retro computer world, but having big effects in some industry arenas, like this thing that was going to happen tomorrow.
Sure. Yeah. And I work in a university, and we're being told to prepare for the possibility that, we'll be holding classes remotely and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
I'm also at a university, and we're having several, emails a day that are leading up to, again, no decision, but it clearly, think about how it's going to work to work remotely.
And you're right. I think we all hope that in the coming weeks that more information is going to be gained quickly, so that, ways to adapt to this will become a little bit more clear than they are right now. I think right now people are erring on the side of caution, and I think that's good personally. Mm-hmm. So, Jack, you've got speaking of places where people congregate.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about Atari hotels?
Oh, man. This popped up in January, and then I haven't been on for a little while. But so, Atari, good old Battle Atari, they decided on their new shtick to make money is they're going to have hotels, Atari-themed hotels. Because it is, after all, only 1980 now, and Atari is the hottest name. That's the first thing people think of when they think of having a good time, is they think Atari. Man, I'm going to go home and play some Atari today. That's what all the kids are doing. That's what everybody wants to do. So they're going to open some Atari hotels. The first one is going to open in Phoenix, apparently, Phoenix, Arizona. They have a website for this, atarihotels.com. There's not a whole lot of information, but I don't know. It's the kind of thing that, if it were 40 years ago, and I was still 9, I would have been like, wow, that's amazing. Of course I want to go to an Atari hotel. But now it's like, I don't know. I can't imagine that a lot of people are going to get super stoked about an Atari hotel.
It is a fascinating choice. At some level, businesses have to have business plans and predictive models and things that they use for this. So they must figure in some way that this is going to be enough of a hit to go for.
Yeah, but remember a couple of years ago they had those speaker hats? The Atari speaker hat.
No, I don't remember this.
We talked about this.
Point made.
Baseball caps with little speakers built in. The speakers pointed down to put noise in your face.
Oh, of course. Why
you know how those have taken off?
Why would those you want that?
The Atari speaker cap really hit the world by storm.
Years.
I mean, they've had so many winners the past decades here. I don't know.
I mean, presumably the idea. Yeah, it's true. I mean, like, it's not like you're just driving down the highway and you need to stop somewhere and you've got to choose like Red Roof Inn or the Atari Hotel. You know, it's like presumably they're assuming that the Atari part is the draw.
Right.
But
And people will go there for that. But, you know, like it, no matter how nice and cool and fun it may be on opening day, it's a hotel and everything's going to get trashed. And, you know, within 6 months, it's just going to be, whatever fun electronic things they put in place are just going to be derelict, broken. I don't know.
From the wires.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
So it says that the hotels will feature common areas following the latest trends in hospitality with a focus on the video game universe and the Atari brand.
Yes.
The Atari brand.
Yeah, because the Atari brand is very much trendy.
Yes.
It's really the latest in what's in technology is you think of Atari. I don't know.
A few years later, I could see the neon flickering, you know, on the Fuji logo on top of the hotel.
Right. Which by now just sort of looks like kind of an L.
Well, I feel the pain. I mean, the things that have happened to the Commodore brand since Commodore went out in 94 have been similar, you know, not as prominent, but I don't think as maybe, but the Commodore enthusiasts knew that the brand was being kind of just batted around with impunity. So,
I will say that on the AtariHotels.com website, they have this. They have a mock-up, a rendering of what such a hotel might look like. It looks pretty cool, like huge Atari logo on the side, that kind of thing. But but if you're in the hotel, you don't even see that. So,
oh, that's true.
But then they have, you know, what was it? I'm sure it was discussed within the past year. There's this supposedly forthcoming Atari console was shown to not, you know, they demoed it, but it wasn't actually creating its own output. And they were featuring Jeff Minter, you know, who did Tempest 4000, all the Tempest 3000, 2000, and many things over the 80s. They said, it'll premiere application will be Tempest 4000. And they're like, no, it won't. no one's talked to us about this. What we don't even know what hardware it's running. No, you know, what is it? Like a big souped up Raspberry Pi? It's crazy. That, and I think that's still a thing that's maybe going to happen. I can't imagine that the hotels will actually happen, but
no, probably not.
Yeah. Well, as it turns out, I've wanted several times within the last decade to tell some big business conglomerate, hey, leave my childhood alone, would you? I guess this will, it could fall into that category, but hey, if I'm in Phoenix and I need somewhere to stay, I'm going to consider it.
Yep.
So the next news item I've got here is like it's like, you know, order of magnitude propeller head. So I'm only going to talk about it just real briefly, but I've enjoyed playing with FPGAs, basically programmable hardware, and have enjoyed trying to get them to do a couple of retro computer things as well as, I guess what you'd say would be the FPGA or the maker Hello World, which is Blink and LED. But there is a YouTube playlist where a gentleman is building a 6800 CPU, basically the logic for one, in an FPGA. And he's using a tool called nmigen, which kind of bridges the world of Python with the world of FPGA programming. I haven't used it, so I'm not intimately familiar with how it works. But the place that Python plays in this is to help generate the hardware description language, which then you load onto the FPGA and make it do its stuff, whatever stuff you want to program the hardware to do. In this case, act like a 6800 CPU. And the way that he got started in this was he had a pinball machine, and I think it had a 6800 as the heart of the machine. And he was wondering, you know, how much longer am I going to be able to find 6800 CPUs or a lot of these chips for that matter? And so I'm going to work on building a 6800 core using this nmigen environment. There's a lot of installments in this, and you got to be dedicated because, I mean, we're talking bits and bytes and clock cycles and the whole nine on this. But if you are into that stuff, then we'll have a link for it up in the show notes.
So what do you think is the distance between what is done in that video series and getting to like a 6502? Because the 6800 is kind of like a sort of ancestor of the 6502,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they're cousins, aren't they? Well, the thing is, there's already a number of 6502 cores out there for FPGAs. One that I was using when I was playing around trying to get a 6502 core to just do something super simple. I think it was called the Arlet core, named after the gentleman who made it. And it's a fairly simple bit of hardware description language. I mean, simple for someone who knows this stuff. I couldn't decompose it, but it's short. It's very tightly written, very good code. And that's why it's been used in a few different projects. And that's why I used it to bring up a 6502 core on one of my FPGA development boards. And I actually programmed a ROM section that would do something simple like read a memory address, the switches that were set, and spit that out at another memory address that had some LEDs attached to it. And when it actually worked, I was like, oh my gosh, I did a 6502 core on this FPGA. I had it read a memory address because the 6502 is memory mapped I/O. So it read some switches and it spat it out on LEDs and woohoo. And that's as far as I got. But that was pretty cool. I mean, it was like this chip was acting like a 6502, not at a software emulation level, but actually at a hardware level. So could you get from his code to 6502? Maybe, but I guess I'm just saying there's already several choices for 6502 out there, and some of them very well understood. I think the Arlet core may not be cycle exact as a 6502, but don't quote me on that. I think there are some other cores that support the 6502 that are much more dialed into, you know, like exact cycle precise emulation of a 6502 chip.
Yeah, I guess part of what I was thinking about was that distant understanding of what NMyGen even is doing, that it might actually be sort of easier to understand the 6502 when using the tools in NMyGen to build it. Like, because I sort of feel like it's a long distance between me and understanding how to build a 6502, but maybe this could shorten the distance so I could sort of understand it, even if I'm ultimately building something that kind of exists already.
Well, I think, you know, there's a couple things there. One is that I've wondered why FPGAs haven't achieved more adoption in the maker community, because it's the ultimate, you know, the way I think of it is, in the 70s, I played with TTL logic chips like ANDs and ORs and yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. This is kind of like having somebody dump a pile of logic chips on you and say, make what you want. You have hundreds of them. You know, it's just so much fun from that perspective that you can actually program at the hardware level. But the languages that you use to do this, like Verilog and VHDL, there's a pretty steep learning curve. And it's not just learning the language, it's learning the fundamentals of digital design, so that when you build something, it actually works and you don't have things happening at times that you're not expecting and stuff like that. For somebody who's not an electrical engineer, and that's me, I'm not one, doing something like this has almost a ballistic learning curve. And I think from what I read, this NMyGen, and it's not the first project I've seen in this space, tries to knock down that learning curve a little bit by saying, here is a slightly more friendly environment with which to build digital circuits. So I'm going to dig more into it. I'm going to learn more about it and try and figure out how it works, because honestly, having something that has a little bit less steep of a learning curve, I think would help the maker community to embrace FPGAs more.
Yeah. Well, and this motivation of like, you know, what if my pinball machine needs a chip that I can no longer find? I mean, like, I think we can all identify with that problem.
Yes. And, you know, people have used FPGAs or microcontrollers or various things to build replacement chips for some of the retro computers. Like, there's a couple of chips you can buy for the Commodore 64 that are based on programmable hardware, and you pop them in and they essentially do the function that original chip did. But the theory is, at least, that they're going to continue to be available on into the future, where some of the Commodore chips are getting more hard to find. So anyway, that's as much as I'll cover that. Like I say, super propeller heady, but look like fun. So I'll finish up the series and hopefully learn some stuff along the way. Jack, it looks like you've got another Atari thing.
I do. So this guy, Pedro Lebianbatic, who is someone who I have met. In fact, I rode in his car when I went to the Retro Gathering last September. He did a cool thing. He works at Spotify. He's a really smart guy. He made what is functionally a sort of Spotify client for the Atari 8-bit. So what he's done is he's got a server component written in Python that's running on something. And then he's got a little bit of Atari code that he wrote that connects to this thing. So now it's not actually transferring audio data digitally to the Atari. It's using a little sort of a trick here. The Atari's SAO port, which is its serial port that it uses for connecting to floppy drives and to cassette drives and almost everything else, actually has an audio inline. So this actually worked. This was used for software that came on cassettes. You could have software that would be intermingled with audio on the cassette that would play it back through your computer, that is through your television speaker. And so he's done the same thing. So he's taken the audio data and playing it through this line somehow. And so it comes out through the computer. And so there's no actual digital decompression going on the Atari to actually generate sound. It's not generating sound, it's just passing right through. But there is something where he's also taking the album art and translating it into sort of a one-bit pattern that he then sends over to display on the screen. It's pretty neat.
That is so cool.
And he made this all open source. It's all on GitHub. You can grab it and play with it if you want. Seems pretty cool. So he used a bit of proprietary hardware for this. I think it would be super interesting to do this using some of the stuff that Thomas Cherryholm and others are working on. This Atari, this FujiNet thing they're working on. This could probably use FujiNet, use their hardware in a more general purpose way to actually connect to a server somewhere and actually fetch music and play it, I reckon, one way or another.
But using that trick of that line on the SIO port that like the 410 used to bring in the audio, that's a cool
hack.
Really cool. So he must have hacked together some sort of a SIO connector to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, so he created his own SAO connector and did something. It's pretty cool.
That's very slick.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. This is echoing really hard for me. Like I feel like we just talked about something like this on an Apple II as well. But I can't, you know, we can't search our show notes because our website is terrible.
I saw it. There was something out there, and I don't know if it was talked about. I think I just saw a picture on Twitter, and someone had a Mac Plus or an original Macintosh.
That's what it was.
Something like that.
It was a Mac, and it was doing something sort of similar to that.
Yeah,
too, I think.
It relied on external hardware, but it would actually pixelate the album art. I mean, it was similar, but I guess it'd be easier to somehow easier to do that on the Mac on an 8-bit Atari.
Yeah.
But I think we're thinking of the same thing.
Can you use Google to search our site, Paul, like site:rcrpodcast.com and then put in your search terms?
It's possible that would work better than like the search box on our actual site.
Absolutely. I find that a lot of sites that even have decent search, I still get better results if I let Google search it for me.
I agree. In general.
That's true.
Huh. Yeah.
Well, that's it for news items. And now, a word from our sponsor.
As a consultant, Leanne Bryant relies on a lot of things to help her test new outdoors equipment. Experience, knowledge, strength, and CompuServe. She joined CompuServe when she started her own business and found ways to work smarter. Through CompuServe, she meets other experts in her field. She books her own travel to save time, and she stays a step ahead of the weather. And when she has a question about software, CompuServe has the answer. For more information about CompuServe, call 1-800-554-4046. Start with the basics like news, travel, and encyclopedia and more for just $8.95 a month. Then go beyond for free software and help with hardware and software problems. And you'll agree with Leanne, that CompuServe is like the outdoors. The more you see, the more you like. CompuServe, the information service you won't outgrow.
And we're back. And now we get to talk about the host's retrocomputing gift idea. I love this thing. I don't know where we got the link, but there's a maker called Evil Mad Scientist, and they have many kits. And I took a look at the various things that they had on their site and just love this one called the Meggie Jr. RGB soldering kit. So if you look at it, it looks like an 8x8 RGB LED matrix. It's got some control buttons on the left that are up, down, left, right, and like a fire and select button over on the right. So it looks like a handheld gaming console, except you've got the amazing resolution of 8 pixels by 8 pixels.
Pretty nice.
Now, I think you could still be creative and do some fun things with this. And sure. Just a fun kit to put together anyhow, it looks like. Don't have any personal experience with these kits, how easy they are to solder. So I can't speak to that. I can just say that it appears that the kit is Arduino compatible. So if you understand Arduino programming, that's going to give you a head start on something like this. And I love LEDs, and I especially love RGB LEDs. Man, I wish those had been around when I was a kid, because they are super fun. And that's our pick for the gift idea for this time around. What do you guys think?
It looks super fun.
Very cool.
Love to have this thing.
Could definitely spend some time going down that rabbit hole, I think. That's awesome.
It does actually look like it's possible to get it even pre-assembled, although one starts to wonder if what the point was then.
Oh, yeah. Something like this I'd want to do as a kit.
You'd want to. Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't look like it. I mean, it looks like you wouldn't need intense soldering knowledge to put this together. Mm-hmm. Just basic.
Well, I don't see any surface. I mean, did they speak to that? It looks, from what I could tell, it looks like it's all through-hole components. I mean, you've got the header up on the top there that is looks like 0.1 spacing, and you've got a through-hole dip chip that I assume in the upper right there is the microcontroller for this, and the rest of the pieces I think are all going to be through hole. I don't know, did they say it in the description?
It doesn't say that exactly, but if you look, there's one picture that is a picture of in the box, what's in the box. So the box is open and there's a bunch of little baggies which all have labels on them indicating what's in them, and one of the baggies is labeled "All your base resistor are belong to this bag."
Perfect.
Wow. Okay, I'm ordering this now.
It's even meme compatible.
Yes. Super cool.
All right.
Wow. That doubles. That actually doubles the greatness of this thing.
Yeah. Evil Mad Scientist has some pretty cool stuff. They also have like a giant 555 timer you can build.
Oh, yes.
I think actually they're the ones that made the big kit of, what is it called? Like Digicomp 2.
And didn't we talk about their 555 when we chatted about the anniversary of the 555 chip? I think somebody made a contemporary 555 kit to commemorate that.
Yeah, they're pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. While you're there, come for the Meggie, stay for the other gadgets. While you're there, take a look at the other stuff on their site, because it is awesome. So let's talk about more stuff we can buy. Blake, it looks like you've got some stuff here that is probably going to be out of my price range.
Let's see. Yeah. Yeah, for the eBay finds, sometimes when I do my eBay scanning, as I do occasionally, I'll put the filter up to, instead of best match in the retro vintage computing area, I'll put the filter to highest price. And you'll find some interesting things and a lot of things that have been around for a while. And I noticed some good ones this time around. Let's see. Well, one of them, and this is more of a understandable price, I think, would be yet another. Now, I hope we haven't talked about this particular one. and stop me if we have, but it's a Apple I, original 1976 computer system, first Steve Wozniak, as it's titled, and it is going for $1,500,000. Now, is this isn't the one that was discussed a little while back, is it, or am I just repeating?
I think my recollection is that we talked about not having talked about it.
Okay.
I mean, it might be a million and a half, but the shipping's reasonable. It's only a dollar, expedited shipping.
Yeah, a dollar. When if you're, it looks, let's see, it's in Boca Raton. So if you live there, if you're in Boca Raton, you can save that dollar by just doing a local pickup. But 1.5. And of course, it begs the question, you know, why eBay? Why are you doing this on eBay rather than Christie's or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
But there it is. I think that might be the most expensive thing on eBay right now. And
it's possible it's the most expensive eBay auction we've ever had on RCR. I don't think we've ever beat 1.5 million, have we?
It's I
don't think so.
It's quite possible that we have not.
That is right up there.
It's buy it now, but it does have a make an offer, so you can you could lowball it a little bit and see where that gets you. But anyway,
there's very little information about this seller, though.
I mean, yes, indeed. Looks like he's sold 100 has 146 interactions, 100% positive. So
right, but all as buyer.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't dig in.
So we can. Yeah. Well.
Wait. Yeah, I'm not gonna. I'm gonna hold back on this one.
I think. But, yeah. RCR buying advice is hold.
Hold on, this red light. So the next item is it's an interesting item, and it's somewhat rare. It's two items together. It's a Apple Lisa One mouse, and these are these can be hard to come by. Often you'll see a Lisa or Lisa Two for sale without the mouse, and I see the mice going for a few hundred dollars. I purchased a Lisa mouse for, I think, $100 some years ago.
Lisa One mice.
The actual Lisa mouse. And it's a distinctive looking thing. It's a little less ergonomic than the Macintosh mouse that followed it, but certainly has a distinctive look, and it's all Lisa. And it's bundled with a really nifty poster. I actually have a very low resolution image of this. I quite like this poster. And that would be nice hanging on the wall. But the thing about this one is the price. It's a little higher than I would have imagined. And actually, let me see. Yeah, you've got the images going. Yeah. It looks like, yep, it's $11,599. So that seems a little on the high side to me. And the mouse, it's in box. I don't think they're, well, new condition, original packing. So it could be that this mouse has never even been, plugged into a Lisa. So you're not going to find much better a specimen, I think, with the poster to boot. But that seems a little high. What do you guys think?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a little. So this one, I'm going to go ahead and hold on this one as well.
There was a one of these did go not in the nice box, but there was a Lisa One mouse that was briefly on the table at Kansas Fest. Someone got it.
Okay.
But
not for this much. It went for a little lower.
Oh well, no, it was on the take it. The first person that gets to it takes it for free.
Ah, okay. Gotcha. Well, that is a better deal.
But these are one cannot expect to find it for free on tables.
No,
these are valuable.
Yes.
I think it's pretty hard to find one for less than a couple hundred dollars, probably.
Yeah. I mean, finding it for free is probably as unusual as seeing it listed for $11,599, actually.
Right.
They're equal in their rarity. But yeah, a little high. I thought that one caught my eye. And additionally, there's another one that seems to be a little higher priced than I thought. It's a Mint new in box. It's a boxed copy, never opened, of Microsoft Office Pro 97 CD. It's a collectible and a movie prop, apparently. So I think if we look at the picture, yeah, it says it's Office 97, professional edition, and collectible, mint, shrink-wrapped. Office 97 was released in 1997. There's no other indication in the description, but apparently it was a movie prop. And one has to wonder what movie this was featured in. I don't see any other indication. And it's priced at, buy it now, of $7,500, which, it says promotional sample, not for resale. Maybe that's what they're interpreting to be
movie prop.
Having used for a movie prop. I'm not sure.
Someone who's running a movie, set decoration would at least remove that sticker.
Yes, that makes the claim seems unbelievable given that. So clearly, but again, buy it now, $7,500, free shipping though. Free shipping. Again, I think I'm going to hold back on that one. And the last item I have is less of a kind of a humorous note as far as price, and something that I'm genuinely curious about. It's it's an item that's priced more modestly at $159.99. Buy it now. It's an Apple II card called the Quantum Leap Smart Chip Card. And the thing that caught my eye was it has an Intel chip on it. And I thought at first, is this a PC emulator or something like that? And it actually has... It has an Intel 8748 chip, which is not a processor, I don't think, but it is and some support chips as well. But I couldn't, looking online and doing searches for 5 minutes or so, I couldn't find any information about this. Does anyone have any clue what this could be?
I only know what I just got from searching, where I see Intel 8748 microcontroller architecture, but I don't know.
It's 1980, dated 1983, and I was unable to find. I didn't go into the particular IC. I was hoping to find some indication on one of the Apple II history sites, but that I didn't find. Are you seeing anything like that?
Not yet.
Okay.
But yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's a very simple looking card. Like, it seems like all of the work there is being done. Oh, in fact, actually, underneath. Like imprinted on the board underneath the card, underneath the chip, it says microcomputer.
It does say I hadn't noticed that microcomputer. Interesting. Yeah.
But maybe that just means this side down.
Or I think they're saying here's the Intel 8748 single chip microcomputer.
And I see there's a
above and below it. It's one whole phrase, maybe.
Yeah. All right.
And I run across a PDF now that I'm digging further. It's a talking about a development system, documentation for development system for the 8748. So I wonder if it's an early sort of system on chip type thing or an embedded processor type situation, I wonder.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, Wikipedia says that the 8748 is part of the Intel MCS48 family, which were microcontrollers. First came out in 76. So it is a processor of some sort.
Quantum Leap Technologies.
Yeah.
That had me thinking for a few moments. I was conflating it with Quantum Link. I thought maybe it was some kind of a serial accelerator for that online service, but that was only Commodore once it turned away from being Apple Link, right? Or
I think that's right. Yeah.
I'm curious about the little double EEPROM thing on the top that... I guess maybe you could program its ROM.
I wonder, are they in fact did you say EEPROMs? Is that what they are?
Well, I don't know if it's a double EEPROM now that you mention it. But okay. I was looking here to see if I could. Yep, it's EEPROM. The Intel 8748 has two 8-bit timers, 27 I/O ports, 64 bytes of RAM, and 1 kilobyte. Of EEPROM. A version with 2 kilobyte EEPROM and 128 bytes RAM was also available as the 8749. So it's a little microcontroller that has some onboard EEPROM that I'm thinking you could program, and then it can do programmable stuff. And I'm wondering what you would have used on the Apple to talk to it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. It's sadly, I mean, there's a company that exists called Quantum Leap Technology, but that's clearly nothing to do with this. And those series of words aren't very good as far as a Google term, because Quantum Leap Technology, it's like searching for the word link or something.
Right.
But Yeah, so I was hoping somebody had heard of it. It seems very a curious thing. I've certainly never seen a photo of it or heard of it before.
Maybe I some found, listener will. Okay, let's see. So I have Call Apple December 1983. Apple II outperforms IBM PC with Super Mini virtual memory technology. And I wonder if this is at least that company. Mm-hmm. So I wonder. So this is the RCR audience gets to see research done as it happens.
This is how the sausage is made.
Yeah. I had no luck before the show, so I thought I'd put it to the rest of you.
It looks like that the Quantum Leap.
The logo seems to match.
The logo matches, yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, so, certainly.
So maybe this is an example of that. I still haven't quite figured out what it is, but
multi-product hardware and software package.
Yeah.
Instant virtual memory expansion. Huh. Super so, basic. That's I don't know.
It's. I mean, it does seem like it might actually be. It's a kind of card that is not the same as other cards I have. You know, like it's not just another 80 column card or another memory card or something like that.
It would be like a coprocessor. It seems like.
It has no connectors. There's nothing that plugs into it. It has no input or output from another. It's not a controller or something that has a device physically attached or anything like that. Clearly.
Yeah. And it's such a simple looking card, but I guess all the work's being done on the chip. Cool.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Add to watch list.
Oh, actually, I just saw something on that PDF you had. It mentioned the smart chip. It's if you look at the on the right side, the second bullet in that right column. One smart chip memory management microprocessor. So maybe this is to do with this virtual memory system that they're talking about. And they mention so-and-so manuals for Megatask, MegaDOS. It sounds like they even have their own sort of the MegaDOS VSOS virtual memory operating system. Is this something that hardware supporting a different OS on the Apple II maybe? It's kind of strange.
This is all, it's all kind of foreign to me. So
yeah, very odd.
Interesting. Yeah, definitely on my watch list now.
Okay.
and not outrageously expensive, so.
And it's a buy it now. Make an offer, $159.
Yeah.
With $8 shipping to
add to cart.
Me from Houston.
Just in case, so I don't forget. Still adding. I have a cart that's full of many, many things. I use my cart as a alternative watch list. So my cart has 54 items in it at the moment.
Well, don't accidentally click the buy button.
I have worried about that sometimes.
So, you know, I'm not necessarily interested in, but I'm not interested in accounting software, as it turns out. But I think that this particular pile of TRS-80 software is super interesting. First off, because it looks like a fairly complete set, and it's the old Radio Shack TRS-80 brown binders, which I always thought were just, you know, kind of strangely compelling for some reason. They have a unique look, let's put it that way.
And they're soft, too.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. The old
puffy,
soft-sided binders. And the other thing that I liked about this was that it's on 8-inch disc, which I think probably means that it went with a TRS-80 Model 2, or maybe one of the later of the TRS-80 business machines that had the 8-inch drives.
This disc that I have up on the screen says Model 16.
16. Oh, there you go. Mm-hmm. There's just not that many 8-inch software packages out there at this point that I'm aware of that you could get. And, you know, theoretically, ideally, if it's not already archived somehow, and it probably is, because some of the TRS-80 enthusiasts are definitely into those more exotic business systems like the Model 2, the Model 16, and even some of the later ones, they've probably archived this already. But if this isn't archived, it definitely should go to somebody who could archive the contents of those disks. After that, I think it's just cool to look at. I mean, I don't have a TRS-80 Model 16, but this software is just kind of fun. And that's why I picked it for my auction. And it seemed like the price was pretty reasonable too, right? What was the price? $49 or something plus shipping?
Well, it's the bidding is underway.
Oh,
so it is by now $56.
Oh, all the way up to 56. Okay. So it seemed like the auction started at a reasonable level. And I think this is, again, just cool to look at. Definitely hope it goes to somebody with some of the more exotic TRS-80s in their collection and that have the ability to archive it if this stuff isn't already.
Very cool.
Yeah, I know. I looked at this and I was thinking about that, like, you know, these are things where, I mean, you know, serious archivists may well have archived it, but like otherwise these are things that no one cares about, you know, like at least some of the business stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Businesses are kind of notorious for just like, you know, when they get the next thing, throwing away the old thing.
Right. On the Apple III side, for instance, you or other folks have managed to archive quite a bit of that business software, right?
Well, yeah. I still have a fair amount to go, but yeah, well, like one of the things that I backed up fairly recently. I mean, well, I guess, I don't know, a couple of years ago now, but it was like a dental office software, you know, like this is a software that you use to like make appointments in dentist's office.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, there were probably were like 9 of those sold total.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that's out there that just never really got captured. Yeah, I think, and also I think on this, so this TRS-80 set has some cassettes as well. They look like actually sort of audio training for Scriptsit. Mm-hmm. And I think the VisiCalc discs actually are 5 1/4 inch for, I think it's this Model 3.
It seems to be a mix of the different types of systems. And I saw Xenix is in there. So that's Model 16. That's a 68,000 based system. But I think some of the other ones are for the Model 2, I'm guessing, which is the 80. It seems just like a mix.
Yeah.
Whatever the case, it's a very cool set.
Yeah. And it is not very expensive. I mean, like it's
well within the range. Where it is now is well within what it's worth. I think it could go up a bit and stay within that range.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what have you got for us, Paul?
All right, let's see. The first couple I have, partly because Blake expressed interest. So the first one, I don't know if this is the one that, Blake, that you were thinking about, but it's a Code Warrior shirt.
Arnold. Yes, I think that's the one. A friend of mine did Code Warrior development, some game development and demo development on the Mac. And at some point with some update, he ended up with this shirt that I thought was the coolest developer shirt ever. And
that's his blood, sweat, and code.
Was that the old MetroWorks stuff?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. They went away in a flash once Xcode, the whole Cocoa development system appeared.
But anyway, yeah. So, and it's clear that the seller knows this is valuable because it's a $99 shirt.
Yeah.
But
did it say what size it is?
XL.
Yeah. And
so
why does it say PlayStation?
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I don't know what the PlayStation, how that figures into any of this.
Well, it is true, I believe, that MetroWorks had for the Mac a version of Code Warrior that would generate code for the PlayStation. I mean, it would like cross compile, but I don't know. Maybe this came with something like that, or does anyone remember that? I'm feeling like I remember that being a thing, or a module that plugged into Code Warrior that would let it export.
It seems kind of likely just because Code Warrior did a lot of this like targeting of other platforms. Like I mentioned last time, I had the Palm one.
Yeah, where, the Palm.
Okay, and let's see. I think there was another MetroWorks shirt, but this is pretty interesting actually, because it's a shirt full of like the woodcut like art that they that they used on their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's super busy.
Is it a button down? Yeah, it's got a collar.
Yeah.
Neat.
It's interesting. Anyway, whatever. I thought it was that was the first one that came up, and this is like a $15 buy it now. So this is like, who knows what size it is? 90S. Maybe that's 90s, or maybe that's something about the size.
I'm thinking that's 90s. I wouldn't mind that shirt, actually.
Yeah. I would wear that shirt. It fits me.
They need a banana for scale.
It says shoulder 21, length 31, fit 23, 1 or XL. Probably L or XL.
They want us to triangulate the overall size from
size
the
is missing
parts.
But, huh. Anyway.
Interesting.
That was sort of interesting. Okay, let's see. So, because I'm kind of running through my tabs blind here, I will just go in whatever order they come up in. So, the next one that is on the screen is a base 2 flashcard set, which I thought was kind of cool. It's a starting bid of $20, so it's pretty cheap. This is a flashcard set that makes the new computer math more easily understood. And
cool.
It's a new math self-study aid. It gives you like cards that where you can like work out the it sort of shows you the binary of like 101100 is 44 in base 10, so forth. I think it's kind of an interesting little artifact of the day, so when computers were on the horizon.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not certain that. I think I'll add that to my watch list.
Can you go back? It looked like that had my name on it.
You're right.
There it is.
They took my stuff, man.
Hold on. Check those boxes in the basement. That's true. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, Earl, this one is for you to buy. It's got your name on it.
Yes, true.
Okay, let's see. What else? Oh, okay. So the next one I had, it's Heathkit ET3400 and ETA3400. And periodically when these come up, I put them in my list and talk about them. So I've, in a number of other cases, I've talked about this. And so I probably won't spend a whole lot of time talking about it, but it's a little trainer. It is I think this has a 6800 in it. Is it not? I think it is. And, you know, it's basically just sort of like the little support structure around the 6800 that allows you to, sort of program it. But the interesting thing about it is that it comes with this add-on expansion, the ETA3400. The ETA3400 is a box that has, you know, some connections for tape input and output, and I think a serial thing, and extra memory is, I think, one of the main things it is, memory I/O accessory. And those are fairly rare. The ET3400 is not super rare, but the memory accessory is a bit uncommon. It does seem to be working, so they show it started up and then saying CPU up, which is what it does when it's alive.
And you're right that the chip is a 6800. I looked it up.
Excellent. Thanks. This started, I think it started at $1 or something like that. It's currently at $29, basically, with 6 days left.
But the shipping is humongous to me, at least. It was 70-some dollars.
Oh, the shipping? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not only is the shipping humongous, but the item itself is somewhat humongous.
Okay.
It does seem like that's a little on the high side for shipping.
Because I'd love to have one of these trainers. I mean, we talk about them every now and then, and I've never, actually pushed the button on one. But this one looks like it's in nice shape, too.
Yeah, and it's nice to have them have it working. Whenever we talk about this, I mentioned that I have one of these ETA 3400 memory things, but whenever I plug it in, it causes, there's something wrong with it. So the ET 3400 that I plug it into works until I plug in this thing, and then it doesn't work.
How much RAM does just an ET 3400 have?
I don't know. Not a lot, but I really don't know. I've done very little with these. There's a little program, like a little sample program that will run LEDs, run little LEDs in a circle, which I've typed in on one, and that's almost the only thing I've ever done. But this one is in pretty good shape. I mean, they're not super, super sturdy, so it's not that uncommon that when you see them, they're kind of cracked.
Mm.
But this one seems to be in fairly good condition. I guess the other thing about these is that they are kits. So in a lot of cases, the ones that you would be considering buying are, just somebody built it, with who knows what skill. Anyway, all right. The next one I have here is a Fox Pro, new in box, unopened. It is a Fox Pro 2.5 sort of update kit. And I think it's probably for the thing on the back says, attention reseller, and gives a bunch of instructions for what the reseller is supposed to do. So I think this is basically something that you weren't normally supposed to be able to buy, but the store could sell to you. And I think the idea is essentially if you were already a user of DBase 4 or maybe some other stuff, Paradox, then you could cross grade or whatever.
Sometimes the ones that weren't directly for resale, you can actually still find because they were, I don't know, sitting on a shelf somewhere. I had a Clipper summer of 87 that I got in the same way. It was still in the shrink wrap, but it was a promotional copy only. Wasn't supposed to be for resale.
Right. Yeah.
I did a riveting YouTube unboxing of it. I think it has like 50 views or something like that.
You know, it's probably the only unboxing that has been caught on video for that, though.
I think it's the only Clipper Summer of 87 unboxing straight from the shrink wrap. Yes, I do. Yeah. I hold the title.
But, I think, you know, I'm not sure that I would recommend buying this particular upgrade thing. It's just that it's kind of interesting to see the ways in which these things were sold. I mean, I think I've talked before about, like, I spent a fair amount of time programming in FoxBase and or FoxBase Fox Pro and liked it a lot. And I have a bunch of different versions of it, but not this one, and I probably won't get this particular one. But it's still sort of interesting just historically to see, like, the ways that they tried to get into the market by allowing these cross grades. Okay. Let's see. Oh, yeah. This is an Apple IIe card cable. So I think we've talked a number of times about the Apple IIe card. Carrington loves it. Mm-hmm. It's a Apple IIe in a Mac. So like the older Mac, there's a certain range of Macs that can take the Apple IIe card. And there's a port on the outside of the card that allows you to plug in a cable that can go to a joystick and then to a disk drive, an actual sort of Apple II disk drive. And this is that cable. And there seem to be many fewer of these cables than there are cards, because the cards can hide in computers and you know, they don't get lost. But the cables are kind of harder to come by. So they often sell for a lot. This one started at $4.50, which is why it caught my attention. If you have a card that's missing a cable.
Yeah, they're not that common, are they?
No. And when you see them, they're usually costly. So this, right. I think we'll see what the market is for this. Now, I see, like, one thing let me look down in the description here. Okay, the description says untested, but looks to be in good condition, and a bunch of other nonsense. So basically, the one thing that I would say about this is that the letters IIE do not appear in here, nor do IIE card. So it's possible that someone who's searching for a cable for the Apple IIe card will not find this.
Not find it.
So.
Yeah, the numeral 2. That's probably why it's not bid up, I guess.
Yeah. I suspect, maybe. I mean, there's a, it was a, I guess it must have been a 5-day auction. There's 4 days and 20 hours left. So it's possible that if you needed one of these, you can. This would be a sneaky way to get it if you watched our YouTube stream, because I don't know if we'll have it posted before then. But anyway, they do appear. I guess one thing, even for posterity, after this auction is long over, it does serve as evidence that they are out there occasionally. Mm-hmm. Okay, here's the next one. This is the one that I'm expecting you guys to talk about. Maybe. Anyway, this is a 500XJ FX Apple II IBM PC joystick. And it has connectors both for the Apple II and for something. I'm not sure what that is a connector for.
I think it's an IBM. That's the Apple II that you're looking at there.
Oh, then, so maybe it is only for the Apple
II. Oh, no. That's actually Apple. That's the internal and the external Apple II connector.
Okay.
You see, remember the 16-pin?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe this is actually only for the Apple II. But there was a Twitter conversation that you guys had about the EPIX joysticks generally. Is this that type?
Yes, but this looks like an analog one.
This is the analog one. The more traditional, you see how the stick is sitting down in that little box that's mm-hmm. Receded, and it has the auto repeat button, the red button, and the trim adjust slider up top. Those are all absent on the classic Atari, the digital, 8-direction stick.
Right.
This is, you certainly saw less of these. It also has two buttons on the side. You see A and B. I had one of these for an Apple IIgs once. And I liked it. I had become a fan of the original 500 XJ. Incidentally, I have at least 9 500 XJ. 6 of them are in eyeshot right now. But it was a nice stick, but somehow it, you know, the analog. I was never a huge fan of the analog stick on the IBM Raffle, I have to say, for the type of games that I typically played. But yeah, it's I think that's a very popular stick model in general, the 500X. Well, apparently it's made by Konix. Am I right, Jack? Isn't it?
I think that's what we realized. Yeah, it's made by Konix, actually.
And if you look it says small print.
Konix.
Yeah, down at the bottom. I think I never noticed that. There are versions of this stick that look like this that have not the Epix logo, but Konix. But not many. I don't have any. That's a good one. That's my favorite digital stick of old, personally.
Yeah, and this one is not one that I don't feel – this does not feel very familiar to me from my Apple II experiences. So I think this not popular on the Apple II, really.
Yeah, I think this is probably just – I think this was never anywhere near as popular as the digital one was for the Atari Commodore.
Yeah. I think Apple II, you picture the Hayes or CH products. You know, everybody had a Mach 2 or Mach 3.
Right.
I think I'm surprised that I thought I remembered that this thing had an IBM and an Apple adapter on it. I mean, they might have had a version because it was the same electronics.
But
I mean, it's oftentimes if you bought an analog stick, like I actually have a behind me is a CH Mach 3 specifically for the IBM, but that's how it was branded. But it actually hanging off of it is an Apple connector as well. So
right. Yeah, and I think I have a couple that work on either type as well. But my recollection is that the connector is wider than.
Yep, it's 15 pins, and typically it was on the sound card, and typically that connector would double as a MIDI interface with the sound card.
Okay.
Yeah, IBMs are weird.
But like we see two cable ends here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, the Apple IIe is the first Apple II that had the 9-pin female connector. Previous to that, the joystick connector was, if you looked at it on the board, it was that plugged into it. It looked like there was a socket for a 16-pin IC. Right. That's what the connector looked like, and it was inside on the board, so you had to you know, open up the thing. And so I guess this will support every Apple II, given that it has that connector. So
okay, the thought is that both connectors we see come out the same end. I was thinking maybe that there was one cable coming out of the joystick, and then you would plug in to an end something else.
I think it's a Y.
It's a Y splitter. Okay.
Yeah, I think it's a Y, and that's how it was always a Y with those particular double IBM / Apple II.
Okay,
they always had that Y. So.
Which always seemed very sort of untidy to me.
It's like,
I don't want an unplugged in thing dangling around.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, that's the end of my auction list.
Well, then I guess we're into the parting shots at this point. What do you guys think, Blake? Got any parting shots for us?
I don't have a great deal of parting shots. probably off to BBS land for a few hours over the next week, as I enjoy doing. And
nice.
Yeah, no major projects. I may end up, I guess, as we said, with a lot more time in the house, depending on how the university goes with remote working. But we'll all see how that happens, how that pans out. But yeah, that's about it.
Well, what about you, Jack?
Yeah, not too much of my end either. As I mentioned, I moved recently, and I've not even unpacked any of my retro computing stuff. It's all in boxes in the next room over. So hopefully I can get my stuff squared away pretty soon here and get to work. I do have some products waiting for me that I should tackle at some point here, but we'll see what I get to when I get to it.
Paul?
Yeah, a large part of my retro computing time has been editing podcasts, as it turns out. but yeah, so I haven't, and work has just actually really been pretty intense of late. So I do work in the university, and spring break just started, so there's a possibility that I could do some of my projects at this point. But we'll see. Unfortunately, so, you know, Blake, you were mentioning, like, well, we'll see how much time you get based on what the university decides. But unfortunately, all my retro computing stuff is at the university. So, so that decision is not necessarily helpful to me.
Well, but, yeah, it's been fairly busy at work. So being physically situated at least would eliminate the drive time to jump onto something. But yes, it sounds like you've, aside from having your collection at the office, you have been quite busy there.
Yeah. I think, I think of that a lot of the fact that I am throwing an hour away of the day by going in and coming back. It's not,
sure.
You know, there are times when I really do sort of feel like that is the time is better spent just staying here. But,
yeah. 45 minutes each way for me. It's, yep. That's a good bit of time. There you go. Yeah, absolutely. Maybe not one of these episodes, but
right. Yeah, I do. That actually is, that is where
time.
I do most of my podcast consuming is while I'm, you know, going back and forth. So,
okay. Probably
just as well in as well. Some sense. I'm not wasting that time entirely.
Yeah, sure.
So, how about you, Earl?
Well, I guess the thing that's kind of calling to me right now is this new, it's a modern language, but for retro computers. Mostly focuses on the Commodore 64, but supports a few other programs. The language is succinctly named Turbo Rascal Syntax Error ; Expected But Begin.
Yes.
It just rolls right off the tongue. And I think,
and you did the same thing I did, which is called it Rascal because it looks like Pascal rather than Rascal. Right.
Yeah, it's not Turbo Rascal. I don't know. Maybe it is. I guess I'll have to hear the person who invented it. But I've done some of the Hello World stuff on it and have looked at some of the demos and compiled them, and it looks really exciting. Pascal was a big language for me in the early days, and this has a very Pascal flavor to it. So,
okay. You're doing this on your Commodore 128, I guess?
Well, the language itself runs on a modern Windows system.
Oh, I see.
And so when it produces the code, one of the cool things is you can click a button and have it launch an emulator like Vice.
Okay.
And it'll you do all that, you know, kind of in a tight environment. And then when you're ready,
you push it over,
slap it on a floppy or an SD card or something like that and move it over to the real thing.
Nice. Sounds fun.
Cool.
Yeah. I think that I'll report back, let you guys know how that's going.
Do.
Excellent.
Cool.
And that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss this show and lots of other things at the Vintage Computer Federation forums. We'll have a link for that up in the show notes. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group, which is at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. We got a great crowd over there. If you'd like to send us feedback, please do. You can find us at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network. Link for that will be in the show notes as well. And if you enjoy the podcast, please write a review for us on iTunes. I was looking at those reviews. I hadn't looked for a long time. I was looking over there recently. People have said some really nice things about us. So I don't know. They must not actually listen to the podcast. But anyway, we thank you for that, though. Honestly, thank you for writing a review. And we appreciate it. So until next time,
Retro Compute.